You're listening to the Gut Biome Podcast, where we take a functional
and evidence-based
approach to gut health. In a world filled with conflicting opinions, we understand that navigating gut health can be challenging. That's why we're here to help.
I'm Dr. Dan, a gastroenterologist in training.
And I'm Greta Rose, a functional nutritionist. With over 20 years of combined clinical and hospital experience, we're here to break down the latest research and deliver practical and easy to understand solutions. Welcome back to the Gut Biome Podcast. We are absolutely overwhelmed with the amount of support and encouragement that we've received from you all from our first episode, or even just launching the Gut Biome Podcast in the first place. So thank you so much. We already have an amazing community around us. But today's episode is something that, Dan, you and I talk often about. And I think it's something we look, I'm mind blown that this is not public information. And I think it's something that we really need to wrap our heads around and provide you all with all of the information that we have. Do you want to introduce the topic, Dan?
Yeah, today we're talking about emulsifiers. So emulsifiers are additives that go into food. And today we're going to be looking at which foods they're in, what the evidence is saying about if they're good or bad, and then what you might want to do about it.
Yeah, and I think we will get quite specific here, where we'll talk about what conditions we definitely want to prescribe a low emulsifier diet. And then for everyone at home, we'll also give out some additional food swaps as well to try and aim for a really reduced emulsified diet. So let's get stuck into it.
Yes, so emulsifiers, a big word. What are they and why does the food industry use them?
So if you don't know what an emulsifier is, I think you'll start to hear it come into the community a lot more. And by the time you're done with this podcast, you're going to be very well aware what an emulsifier is. So an emulsifier is something that holds our food together, and the food industry has used it to make our foods more appealing, more visually appealing, more texturally appealing. So when you put something in the mouth, it has this nice, smooth, rich consistency. And so we often find it in a lot of our dairy products. So your ice creams, your yogurts, a lot of your non-fat, low-fat milk will also have the emulsifier in there. And it's also to make sure that all of the ingredients in the product actually bind together and don't separate like the old school milks used to do when we had that nice creamy top layer of milk sitting at the top.
Greta, you're breaking my heart. I'm from Belgium. I love dairy. What kind of dairy products are we talking about here?
Look, it's making sure that we just be selective about the types of dairy products that we're having. We're finding them in our ice creams and our milks, but we're also finding it, sadly, look, your heart gets broken with dairy, my heart gets broken with chocolate. It can be in a lot of our chocolate products, but we've also got it in salad dressings, beer, interestingly, deli meats, but I guess you can kind of understand that. We've got to pull together meat that naturally doesn't sit together. Interesting, they're in some nutritional supplements. And when you're looking at it from a nutritional label point of view, you definitely want to look out for the carrageenan, spelled C-A-R-R-A-G-E-E-N-A-N. It took me quite a while to even pronounce it. But when you're looking at it from those numbers and thickeners, emulsifiers, and you don't understand it, it's the E407. That's the number you want to stick clear from. So I've got your phone on you. Write that name down. Write that number down. And these are the ones you, if you go into a supermarket and pick up a product and can see either of them on the food label, please, this is your warning, this is your clue to put that product back and try and find an alternative form.
Yeah, so E407 is carrageenan, and E407A is a modified version of carrageenan as well. So E407 and E407A.
Yes. My gosh, even as a nutritionist, I get so overwhelmed and confused with all of the numbers that they use out there. So I could only imagine what the general public feel when they look at different products. But once we start seeing letters and numbers that we don't understand, that's usually a pretty clear indicator that it's really gone past a real food source.
And so there's a number of emulsifiers, such as P80, methylcellulose, maltodextrin, and carboxymethylcellulose that we think are probably bad, but the one we really want to talk about today is carrageenan. And we wanted to do that because there was probably the most evidence and research in that one.
Yeah. And you will, I think we've caught this right on the cusp of it. I really think the conversation is now starting to come up about carrageenan. And even Dr. Dan and I, do you remember going to that conference? We went to a gastro conference, Australian Gastroenterologist Week last year in 2023. And they were speaking nonstop about emulsifiers in all of our inflammatory gut conditions.
Yeah, there was some excellent research there by the dietitians and nutritionists who had pulled together all emulsifiers and did some really good trials on feeding ulcerative colitis patients and other inflammatory bowel disease patients just emulsifiers versus ones without.
Yeah. So that was the first time I had ever heard about a low emulsifier diet. And I think it's interesting because I guess nutritionists, dietitians, doctors, and even the general public want to classify diets into different subcategories to, I guess, prescribe a specific type of diet. But if I just explained where we find a lot of our emulsifiers, and they are in a lot of our, I guess, processed foods. Mm-hmm. And look, there's yogurt, there's natural Greek yogurt, and then there's your yogurt that's flavored and it's got, I don't know, strawberry Kool-Aid throughout it, and it's like quite sweet, and it's a very...
Don't say custard.
I'm pretty sure you'll find it in custard as well. I think we went shopping and tried to find custard without the emulsifier in it. I don't remember.
And we just gave up, did we?
I think so. But it's when I explain it, a low emulsified diet is a proper whole foods diet. And we are so anchored into trying to give you a prescribed diet where at the end of the day, everything just keeps coming back to this whole food, real food diet, which is what essentially a low emulsified diet would be.
So to summarize, emulsifiers are everywhere. And there's a few that we think are especially bad. The food industry uses them to thicken and to make the textures better. And we will be talking about carrageenan.
So that leads us into having a good chat about what's the evidence actually saying. Because we're hearing more and more about emulsifiers, but let's have a look and a big deep dive into what the research is telling us. Do you want to start off, Dan?
Yeah, I think there was an excellent report done in 2018 by the European Food Standards Agency, and they had a really close look at carrageenan when it came for them to either recommend or recommend against the use of E407 in foods. And they did an extensive review where they went through all the lab data, all the animal data as well, and then some of the human studies, to really lay out what we knew and what we didn't know. And it had some alarming as well as interesting points.
Ooh, suspenseful.
Yes. Carrageenan is made from red seaweed. So in itself, it doesn't appear to be that harmful. We know that in a Western diet in the 70s, people might have been consuming about 100 milligrams per day of carrageenan. Unfortunately, now it's up to 2,500 milligrams a day.
Gosh, that's mind-blowing, isn't it?
That's quite a lot, yeah. And like you said, the main way to avoid it is to go for a whole foods diet. Now, the problem with it is that in the lab environment, we know that carrageenan itself stimulates inflammation in cells. Sometimes it's used as the actual trigger to show inflammation in the lab, and that's well known. It seems to activate the immune system, the innate part of our immune system. That is the first line of defense. And we also know it causes chronic inflammation in rats when they are injected with it. Now, obviously, we don't go around injecting ourselves with carrageenan. So it's really about what the real life scenario is. And that's where the argument is about how much do we absorb of carrageenan. So we've got this thickener substance. It binds to lots of proteins. And then if it goes in our mouth, how much of it comes out again at the bottom end unchanged? So there's some conflicting evidence there. Some studies say that 98% comes out of our colon unchanged again. And then other studies seem to say in rats that that the carrageenan appears in their urine. So clearly it has traveled through the body, got to the kidneys, and then gets filtered out. So there must be some absorption that's happening. As far as we can tell so far, the carrageenan itself in normal humans is not that big of a problem. The main concern in the literature is the breakdown products of the carrageenan. When carrageenan gets broken down to very, very small particles, it becomes something that's intensely carcinogenic, and it has been listed as carcinogenic since at least 1982.
Oh, gosh.
Now, the question is, does this happen in the human body or not? So even if 98% of it passes out unchanged, is any of this process into these dangerous compounds, is that happening in the gut as well? And we don't really know. There are some mechanisms where that might happen. For instance, it could be being degraded by bacteria in the colon, and they might be producing sulfides, and those sulfides in itself can cause inflammation. And perhaps the industry standards are not quite tight enough to specify how much of the carrageenan is not in this very small, dangerous amount when it gets packaged, when it gets processed, and what happens in the food as it gets stored before it gets into our body. So there's lots of unknowns there, but there are some alarming findings. So we know that if that breakdown product is ingested, and there was a study done in monkeys, that their monkeys start having blood in the stool. So that's quite a dramatic finding.
So before we talk about the actual effects that they're having in us and the results that they're having, I just wanted to be quite clear about what you just mentioned before, because look, red seaweed, that to me is part of a whole foods diet, right? Is that not a natural product? So we're using some type of compound in red seaweed to use in our food to help it hold it together. And that's what we're not confident in knowing if that's affecting. It's more the metabolites, once they've broken down in the body, that's what we're worried about. Is that what you're finding?
Yeah, that's right. And it seems to be that carrageenan definitely has some inflammatory properties to itself.
Its red seaweed form?
So I think that's a bit simplistic. There's three different forms. They are basically molecules that look a little bit similar to galactose. They're two molecules that are bound together in different ways, and that produces different forms. Most of those molecules stay large, but there's a few problems even with these large molecules. So the bridge between the molecules is made with a bond that we know we make antibodies to. And this is the same bond that people with a meat allergy react to. What we don't know, because there is just not enough research, is when we make these anti-Gal antibodies, which are the same ones in the meat allergy.
Is that the mammalian meat allergy you're talking
that's,
about?
That's the one, anti-Gal syndrome. Mm. What we don't know is what effect that has. So in itself, the carrageenan probably has some inflammatory properties already. Then the other concern, as I mentioned, is when the bacteria in our colon break it down, does it create disulfides? Does that cause inflammation? And then the third concern is if it gets broken down in any way, either before it gets in our mouth or somewhere in the human body that we're not aware of, into these very fine, small molecules, these breakdown products.
Or in the manufacturing process?
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, anywhere in the manufacturing
process.
From its
natural form.
Sure. From its natural form, in the storage of it, in the storage of the food once it's found.
Yeah.
What we don't know is whether any of these become this potentially carcinogenic.
Yes. And for those people at home, carcinogenic is cancerous. There is confirmed or suggested discussion about it being a precursor for cancer. Is that correct?
Yeah. So the International Agency for Research on Cancer in 1982, because of this degradation product, listed it as a possible human carcinogen. So it's a possible human carcinogen. So it's possible, it's not confirmed. And they grade that as group 2B, where usually group 1 is the highest level of likelihood of a carcinogen. So because of all these uncertainties, that's why it's still being used.
Okay. Yeah, but I do think with all that research we found, and we'll go into it, we'll move now into how it's coming up and showing up and affecting conditions. With all of this information now starting to come up and the research that was at the conference last year as well, it's hopefully something that's going to be revised because it seems like 1970s, we had this really beautiful, wholesome diet. Then food storage came in and long life things came in and emulsifiers, and we thought that we hacked life. But it sounds like we've really, these things are now starting to come out of the closet about it actually affecting our health. Because to go from 100 milligrams to 2,700 milligrams a day, that's a huge jump.
There's a huge jump. And obviously the question is whether it is harmful in a normal colon. And that's where the evidence isn't quite clear yet, but there's definitely enough for us to pause for concern.
Of course, yeah. All right, well, let's have a chat about what's the evidence saying in conditions, because I've come across some very interesting research. Do you mind if I jump into it?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, so this was research done for our ulcerative colitis patients. And ulcerative colitis is, it's an inflammatory bowel condition that if anyone has either had it or knows someone that has it, it's really not pleasant. So what they did is they had a group of 15 participants. I know it's a small study, but it's still interesting data. So 15 participants, they were placed on a carrageenan-free diet over a 12-month period. Now, after this 12-month period, they were all completely in remission, meaning no signs and symptoms. They didn't have inflammation in the gut, which is fantastic. This group of 15 participants were then randomly allocated. Half were allocated a carrageenan capsule, and the other half were given just a plain placebo capsule with nothing in it. Now, the carrageenan capsule had 200 milligrams of carrageenan per capsule, and that was to take per day. And if we can go back to what we were saying, comparing our intake from the 1970s, we were having 100 milligrams. Now today, in the typical Western diet, we're having, what was it? over
2,500
milligrams. So giving a participant 200 milligrams per day is really not a lot at all. It doesn't even come close to what we're consuming in the Western diet. But interestingly, let's have a chat about what they found. So 12 people completed the whole study. 3 patients in the carrageenan group relapsed, where 0 relapsed in the placebo group. And what they mean by this is they were having a look at their calprotectin, which is your inflammatory marker in the gut. And they found that three participants in that carrageenan group had elevated leveled or higher levels of inflammation or calprotectin in the gut, where there was 0 effect in that placebo group. And I think it's studies like this where we're basically getting them all down to baseline, a carrageenan-free diet, which basically is a whole food, no processed, no emulsifier diet. And then we're selectively and calculated introducing them back into the diet to see their effect. What do you think about that, Dan?
Yeah, I have some problems with the study. It's a small study. Some of the effects are not statistically significant, which is a marker that we tend to set. And in the end, only 3 patients out of 5 in the carrageenan group showed some kind of effect towards having a relapse, which is pause for thought, given that 0 in the placebo group had that effect. But given the small size of the study, it's very hard to say, oh, there we go, the carrageenan was doing that. So unfortunately, this study would have been a lot more powerful if it was bigger.
Yeah.
And that's the problem that we continue to find in the field, as we talked about in the first episode.
Yes, we need more big pharma people in food as medicine. And we need avocados to make a lot more money than they do, so then they can support a lot of our research.
That's right. And look, there are some other studies out there as well, but they are from a long time ago. There was a study in 1970 by a chap called Bonfils, B-O-N-F-I-L-S. And this was not a randomized trial either. So again, this is very poor quality research. But he gave 10 ulcerative colitis patients 10 grams of the carcinogenic form of carrageenan for 10 days. And he could not find any evidence of absorption. And he did sigmoidoscopies, which are mini colonoscopies, and he could not see any changes in terms of ulcers. But again, this is a very small study. It's not comparing to placebo. And he's doing this for just 10 days. And back in 1970, we had absolutely no biochemical markers like we do now to monitor inflammation. We had very basic, I can think of one marker we had back then, ESR, which is absolutely not where we're at now.
Yeah, my gosh, the field of gut health has changed so much just in the last 10 years, let alone back from the 1970s.
But what we do have is that there are studies looking at the effect on the microbiome of having carrageenan itself. So there was an okay study by Nayami in 2021, where she basically used stool samples and then kept them in the lab and then gave them carrageenan.
The stool samples?
To the stool samples, yeah. It's a method called mini bioreactor arrays, MBRA. And then they analyzed what happened to the microbiome after that. And they didn't just do it in carrageenan, and they also did it in PAT and glycerol stearate. And what they found was that the carrageenan and the other emulsifiers, they really decreased the abundance of good bacteria, the ones that have anti-inflammatory properties, specifically a bacterium called Fecalibacterium, whereas some harmful bacteria were increased by carrageenan and other emulsifiers in the Bacteroides family of bacteria. So we do know that it has an effect on the microbiome, but once again, there's some worrying data out there, but it's very hard at this stage to draw strong conclusions.
And you know, hearing that alone, and I'm sure there are some very new big words for some people listening about Fusobacterium and different strains in the microbiome, but hearing that makes allows me to understand that, yeah, you're right, it may not be the carrageenan, it may be the byproducts from the bacteria actually growing and feeding on the carrageenan. Because we do know that the microbes Dr. Tan was just speaking about do have inflammatory effects on the gut.
That's right. And it definitely is a bit risky to start giving carrageenan to your vulnerable patients that already have some damage in the gut. I don't know, Greta, in what kind of conditions do you tend to suggest that people stay away from the damaging emulsifiers?
So look, if we can take a macro view on this and step back a bit, carrageenan is having a link with intestinal permeability. So leaky gut, from more of a general term, it's damaging the mucosal lining. We do know that it's disrupting the gut microbiome, and we do know that it's causing inflammation in the gut.
And that's absolutely right. And we see that both in the lab and also in studies with rats. Those studies, again, are way too small for me to go into, but they are there.
Yeah. And so I think for the healthy general public, it's great for us to know that. But then if there's any practitioners listening, when do we need to go in and actually prescribe a carrageenan or an emulsifying free diet? And in my opinion, I really think if there's anything intestinal permeability that we're looking at, I know that celiac disease will cause intestinal permeability. There's ranges of other conditions out there that are causing intestinal permeability, ulcerative colitis, inflammatory bowel disease. Can you think of any more that would cause intestinal permeability?
Yeah, so like you said, the family of inflammatory bowel diseases, including Crohn's and microscopic colitis.
Yeah. So those are the ones I would definitely be having a big chat to patients about. And you know what's actually high as well in thickeners and emulsifiers is gluten-free diets.
Yeah, right.
And if you're a patient of mine, you'll hear me harp on time and time again about, yes, let's try gluten-free, but let's do it very, very well, because there's a lot of unwanted products in those gluten-free products out there. So definitely if there's Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis, I'm definitely going in there and talking to them about, yeah, look, not only just carrageenan, but your emulsifiers and your thickeners and I guess your processed foods. Dysbiosis is another one that I would think about as well. And I'll explain a bit about what dysbiosis means. We will do another episode about what the microbiome is, but dysbiosis is an imbalance of these trillions of microbes that we have living in the gut. And an imbalance of these microbes can just cause a bit of havoc on our health and our gut health. And so if we're noticing there's dysbiosis there from anything to do with antibiotic use, antimicrobial, antifungals, medications or surgeries, we definitely want to make sure we're not disrupting that microbiome any further, which, my gosh, does this open another can of worms of the type of food people are served in hospital and potentially the high amount of emulsifiers that are in them as well.
Yes, don't get me started on the amount of patients that complain to me about the food.
It's a very uphill battle to even address what's being served in hospitals when we are supporting some of our sickest patients.
Yeah, we fight the battles we can win.
Exactly.
Look, there are some resources out there if you want to find out more and do your own research. If you want to read the report that I read in depth, it's a report by the EFSA, and it was published in 2018. And it's called re-evaluation of carrageenan and processed Yucuima seaweed E407 as food additives. And you can read just the panel getting frustrated about the lack of data they've been provided, about the lack of data in the research as well, about whether people have looked how much of the small particles of the carrageenan is in the food, and also scratching their beards and their hair at the lack of research in humans. There are other resources as well. So there's another European agency called EFIMA, the European Food Emulsifiers Manufacturer Association. And they have some good resources, although their website seems to be pretty unnavigable for me. But you can get behind the homepage by Googling EFIMA Emulsifier Index. EFIMA Emulsifier Index. The latest list was produced in 2019. And it lists some of the emulsifiers that people are worried about. And then in a very odd corner of the internet, we found another resource on emulsifiers. And that was from a association that only looks at cavernous malformations, which is somewhat rare abnormal blood vessels in people's brains. And in a corner of their website, under lifestyle and then under microbiome gut health, is a very good traffic light system for emulsifiers, if that's something you're worried about after today's talk.
Yeah.
The website is called alliance2cure.org. alliance2cure.org. And then go to cavernous malformation in depth, to lifestyle, and then to microbiome/gut health. And you'll find that traffic light system in the links there, along with some of the research that they have based those recommendations on.
Yeah, I thought that was a fantastic one. And I think it also showed us that there are some better emulsifiers out there.
Yeah, the emulsifiers they said were okay were guar gum, gum acacia or gum arabic. Cellulose itself seems to be, if anything, anti-inflammatory and promoting mucosal integrity. Calcium phosphate and arabinogalactan seem to be beneficial. And then there's other emulsifiers such as alginate, which can also be beneficial. But the red ones to stay away from are carboxymethylcellulose, CMC, carrageenan, maltodextrin, methylcellulose variation, and P80.
Yes, which all to me sounds like a complete different language.
Well, I think that's the difficulty. So some emulsifiers might be good, other emulsifiers might be bad.
Yeah.
That's very hard for general Joe public to wrap their head around and for the press to write good stories about to communicate these things.
Yeah.
And then even the ones that are read, as I've tried to explain in this episode, the evidence is shocking, really, for something that almost all of us consume.
Yes, and in very high amounts.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I do really think there needs to be more government funding into producing good quality trials.
Yeah.
About these red emulsifiers that are throwing up some safety worries.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I'm going to quickly run through what foods they're in again, and then we'll have a chat about how to find good alternatives. So just as I mentioned before, we're finding them in a lot of our reduced fats or no fat products. So anyone doing skim milks out there, please look at your nutritional labels. Ice creams, we're definitely seeing it in ice creams and a lot of yogurts. I spent about 2 hours the other week walking through Coles and Woolworths, standing in the aisles for hours looking at ingredients. But I came across it time and time again. And I think about doing up an Instagram post going through some brands that we want to stay away from and ones that we want to switch over to. But yes, your ice creams, your yogurts, your chocolates, sadly, salad dressings, deli meats, where also you, Dan, found that it was potentially a browning inhibitor in fresh fruit.
Yeah, and that's rather worrying because that's a bit counterintuitive.
Because that takes away from the whole foods diet.
It does. And you know, there's other health concerns as well. People who are trying to follow a healthy diet, check your protein shakes and your powders because there might be carrageenan in there as well.
And I think something worrying you also brought up was that it traps water in poultry, ham, and red meat products, I guess, creating quite plump and hydrated meats.
Yeah, and we've known for years the companies make more money. They pump it full of water, the processed meats, to give it more bulk and more weight for you to buy. But one of the ways they do that is to use carrageenan to bind these products.
I actually watched something about this the other day, and they got a bit of stir-fry beef that was cut up. One from Woolworths, one from a small butcher. Exactly the same amount of weight on a scale. And then they cooked it down, and then they weighed the end products, and they found that one was 100 grams less than the other because the water had been cooked out of the meat.
The supermarket one.
The one from Woolworths. Yeah. So yes, we are getting sold.
And other supermarkets.
Yes, yes. But yes, we're getting sold very expensive water that is not needed.
And to summarize then, really, we've got these ultra-processed foods we want to stay away from, as well as a few other ones. But that's something we've known for a long time. We want to look for...
As in the foods?
Yeah.
Yes. When we are looking at the type of foods we want to be having, like, please, number one thing is make sure you go and look at your nutritional labels. It will be written on there, and maybe I'll do some more education about how to read food labels, but that's the only way you're going to find out if these products are in there. If you're a yogurt drinker or an ice cream eater, with your yogurts, just try and go as natural as possible. A yogurt should only have milk, maybe a few cultures in there, a bit of salt, and that's it. We do not need any colorings. We don't need any flavorings in there. Cut up your own strawberries at home. Put honey into your yogurts if you want that flavoring. Even there's some really good jams out there that are quite minimal ingredients. You can put your own jam in and sweeten it up.
And stabilizers seem to be often in the ingredient list as well.
Yes, absolutely. So anything, kind of a rule of thumb, if you pick up a yogurt, look over the ingredient list. If it's got more than 5 ingredients, put it back and find something else. You definitely want to do the same with your ice creams as well. So try and go for more of your vanilla flavors and add whatever you want at home. With your chocolates, have a good look. Have a good look at what's out there. There's some really nice, good, clean products. I sometimes find if you can find European chocolate, which is always the best.
Yes.
Dan's mum often sends us your chocolate over from Belgium that unfortunately doesn't make it over because
doesn't travel well.
It doesn't have your emulsifiers and your thickeners and everything else in it. Its chocolate should go bad if it's traveling on an airplane.
And that's to survive the Australian extreme conditions. And the US chocolate also has different stabilizers in.
Yeah.
But it's not necessary.
Yeah, yeah. So yes, try and find your European chocolates. I know Aldi does some great European chocolates. But look, word of advice, go back to your whole fruits and vegetables, your really good quality meats. I would try and get butcher over your big supermarkets, or even go straight to the farmer if you can. There's some great companies now out there trying to get direct farmer to consumer, so please go and source those things out as well. But look, the
so
more
that's, try and find big farmer, the people working the land, not the drug companies.
Yes.
I just thought I'd clarify that for our listeners who don't speak,
who are trying to buy meat from Big Pharma.
In an Australian accent, yes.
But yeah, look, you'll hear us talk more and more about the research around different foods and different things that are affecting the gut, and everything just goes back to that Mediterranean diet, that whole foods diet, which is basically plant-based with really good proteins in there as well. Rice, pumpkin, sweet potato, all of your fruits and vegetables, because it will sort out 99% of all of these emulsifying issues.
Greta, I think I need some more cooking lessons from you.
All right. Okay, well, let's wrap this one up. Please, I hope you all have some takeaway solutions, and I want to see all of you guys out there in the aisles looking at your food ingredient lists, or go straight to your cupboard and actually have a look at what is in the foods that you have in at home.
And we might even be producing some stickers for your bumper for your car that says no to E407.
All right. Well, like always, please submit all of your questions through at the Gut Biome Clinic website or DM us on Instagram at Gut Biome Clinic. And we'd love to hear from you all. Thank you so much for listening in today. We had a fantastic time running through emulsifiers, giving you the real hard evidence and pulling it apart, and giving you solutions on how to actually decrease your emulsifier intake.
And next time, we will be talking about the loaded topic that is constipation. It is everywhere around us, it affects everybody, and I'm very much looking forward to our chat. So stay tuned.
See you next time.
Bye.
The Gut Biome Podcast. The Gut Biome Podcast. Gut Biome Podcast. The Gut Biome Podcast. The Gut Biome Podcast.